Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Wednesday, February 18th. Last time, which was a week from today, you had a test. And then, of course, Monday there was no class because it's a holiday. It's really hard to build up steam in this class for summer. We got so many days off. But anyway, hopefully you put those days to good use and actually study a lot on those days you have off. Because that's the nature of this class for most students. You really have to apply yourselves in this class. Okay, so in lab, you'll get the tests back, but there are a lot of times the lab instructor doesn't know you had a test the previous time or the previous week, so they don't know that they have a test for them waiting to be picked up and passed out to you. So just let your lab instructor know that you've just taken a test, and they should go check and see where it is so that you can see it during lab. And that's probably going to be really true for the Friday class. All right, so because I never see Sung-hee anywhere around. All right, so just let them know and they can find the test. And also remember that once we pass the Scantron back to you guys, we just don't regrade it. So it's good to go over the test with your Scantron right with your instructor. You know, and they're happy to do that. It takes a little bit more time, but usually there's enough time in lab to do that. So then if you find that the Scantron made a mistake or you smudged up the Scantron or something funny, you can get credit for that particular question. But once we surrender a Scantron to a student, you know, I don't regrade it for them, right? That's just like for the sign-in sheet, which I'm going to pass around right now. If you don't sign the sign-in sheet, please don't come to me in a couple weeks and say, please, can I sign the sign-in sheet from such and such a date? Because I'll never be able to remember if you're in class or not. All right, so now's the time to sign the sign-in sheet for attendance purposes. All right, so does anybody have any questions over the test? And if for whatever reason you missed lab, you definitely should go back and look at the test and why you answered a certain way on a particular question. And sometimes you'll realize you just didn't know the answer, but there's going to be a lot of times you're going to say, oh, well, I just misread the question, or I didn't mark down the answer that I wanted on the Scantron, or just made just kind of a careless mistake. So it's really important that you go back and look at the test in your Scantron and see what happened, okay? All right, so let's see, what else? Oh, when after you guys are done with lab, then you should work with each other and your lab instructor on the study materials and the exam figures for the test, you know, even those quantitative problems. That should just be first nature to you on how to figure those things out. It doesn't look like the quantitative problems that we have coming up on the next chapters are really quantitative, but I'll try to work something out so that they're a little bit quantitative. Okay, they're still just kind of regular word questions. All right, so we left off in chapter 4, and we're talking about enzymes. So let's just kind of review a little bit what an enzyme does. What does an enzyme do for us? I like that answer. It speeds up a reaction. It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. But can an enzyme make a chemical reaction happen that won't happen by itself? No, it just speeds up the reaction. It can convert substrate into product in a process that might take 20 years. It can maybe do it in less than a second. That's what an enzyme does, right? And how does an enzyme do that? What does it do? By lowering the activation energy, right? And it removes some kind of energy barrier. The best way to think about an energy barrier is that an enzyme put two substrates together in just the right way that a reaction can take place, right? So that molecules just don't bump into each other in all kinds of futile, random ways. The substrates bump into each other exactly the one way that a product can form. And in order for an enzyme to have that proper activity, what must it have? It must have an active site, because the enzyme substrate complex has to form before products are formed. All right, but I'm actually thinking at even a little bit simpler level. In order for an enzyme to have the proper function, it has to have the it has to have the proper, and what you said, yeah, what you said was exactly correct. I just am saying it a little bit differently. It has to have the proper shape, right? And so the shape of the active site has to match up with the shape of the substrates. And what happens to the function if you change the shape of an enzyme? Yeah, the function changes, right? So that's a nice structural functional relationship, even at the molecular level, right? A relationship between what? Anatomy and physiology. So we do have to know anatomy in here, even of molecules. All right, so talking about the anatomy of molecules, we got a couple little particles right here called cofactors and coenzymes. And a cofactor is just a really, really small molecule, and it's usually an ion, all right? So it has a charge associated with it. It can bind to an enzyme, and when it binds to an enzyme, that's like poking you in the side. What happens to you? You change shape. That's right. You're going to move around. So a cofactor is going to change the shape of an enzyme, and when the shape of that enzyme changes, guess what happens? The activity, the function of that enzyme changes. It usually increases. It has activity. All right, so a cofactor includes these metal ions like calcium, magnesium, manganese, copper, zinc, selenium, and even cobalt. We need a little bit of cobalt in our body, which is CO, in order for enzymes to attain the proper shape so that they can bind the substrate, so the enzyme-substrate complex can form. So what forms after the enzyme-substrate complex? The products form. That's right. So these things are necessary for that enzymatic activity. And since we call these cofactors, they don't get used up during the chemical reaction. They're recycled over and over again. The second kind of molecule is a lot bigger. And it might even be as big as the enzyme itself. These are what we call coenzymes. And coenzymes are large organic molecules. And sometimes your body can synthesize these things, and other times it can't. They're too complicated. So if your body can't synthesize one of these organic compounds, where do you get it from? You have to have it in your diet, right? It has to be in your diet, right? If your body can't make it. And all vitamins your body can't make. That's why we call them a vitamin. They're an essential nutrient. They're a very complex organic molecule. They have to be in your diet because the human body has lost the ability to build those compounds. And what a coenzyme does is that it doesn't bind to an enzyme to change the conformation. It just sort of acts as a participant in the reaction. It will carry a product from one metabolic pathway to another, or it will carry the product from one organelle to another. So it acts like a transporter molecule. It's going to transport something from one enzymatic reaction to another. So it's like just a little carrier. Almost, you could think of it almost like a little transfer RNA molecule that's running around inside the cell. Okay, so these are not small like cofactors. They're not metal ions. These are large organic molecules. All right, we're gonna see some examples of these things. All right, so here we see an example of a cofactor. Okay, so a cofactor is what? Just a small metal ion, for instance, and it can bind to an enzyme. And when it binds to the enzyme, it changes the active site so that it is complementary to and accepts the substrates. And when the substrates bind, so this, what would we call this complex right here? Yeah. Yeah, that's the enzyme-substrate complex. It doesn't have a special name because I also see it's binding a cofactor here, but you know what? I would guess somebody has developed a term for an enzyme-substrate complex that has the proper cofactor bound to it. I just don't know what it is. All right, and now what can happen after this point? After the enzyme-substrate complex, what happens? The products are released, you get the enzyme back, and you get this cofactor back as well. It dissociates, okay? All right, but without the cofactor binding right here, the substrates won't bind, or the activity is way reduced, and the rate of the reaction is not really enhanced. All right, so in this particular case, where did the cofactor bind? Did it bind to a site within the active site or some secondary site, someplace on the outside? Yeah, some secondary site. Right? A cofactor can even bind within the active site, like what we see right here. So the cofactor binds to the active site, and now, right, the active site is a finished product. It has the complementary shape to the substrates, and so here is a competent enzyme-substrate complex, and the products can be made. So cofactors can bind at some distant location to the active site or even within the active site to promote binding of the substrates. And then after this, the products are formed. So that's what a cofactor does. So give me an example of a cofactor. Magnesium is a really good one. We find that all over the place. All right? There might be some other kinds of metal ions. Maybe like a chromium ion. Did you see chromium on this list right here? Did you see chromium? I see copper, zinc, selenium. But chromium can be an ion. And guess what chromium can do? It can maybe bind to this site here or to this site here. But chromium doesn't have the same shape. Say maybe this should be a magnesium. Doesn't have the same shape as magnesium. So what would that chromium do? It's going to actually poison that enzyme, right? Because now it has the wrong shape. And that's why sometimes these small metal ions are actually very poisonous. You can't have them in very large quantities in your body, right? Because it wrecks the shape of the active site. Okay. Enzyme activation. So many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. A really good example of this would be, for instance, in the pancreas. The pancreas produces digestive enzymes. And where does most digestion take place in your body? Your stomach, small intestine, for instance, right? But it's the job of the pancreas to produce those digestive enzymes. Now, what would be terrible is if in the pancreas that produced digestive enzymes, if they were activated and released in the pancreas, because what would happen? Yeah, it would digest the pancreas away. And you know what? That happens all too frequently with somebody with pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer, and the pancreas just dissolves away. Almost impossible to treat, right? But in the healthy individual, those digestive enzymes are secreted into a duct and they're carried to the small intestine where they are activated, and that's where they perform their function, their normal and proper function inside the digestive tract. Okay, so that protects the pancreas against self-digestion. Many enzymes are activated by phosphorylation and deactivated by dephosphorylation. So can you remember what that functional group looked like? What does a phosphate group look like? It's a PO4. It's a phosphate element with four oxygen atoms around them, and depending on the ionization state, there might be hydrogens on those oxygens. So it's a relatively large molecule, and it has a lot of charges. All right, it's highly hydrophilic, and so when that's added to an enzyme, that's like poking you with two or three fingers, right? Because it's a big molecule. So it's going to have a major change on the conformation of that protein. So it could shift that protein from an inactive form to an active form very easily. So phosphorylation or dephosphorylation is a common way that many enzymes in our body are controlled. They're turned on or off by that phosphate molecule. That phosphate molecule acts like that switch on the wall for turning the lights on and off. Okay. Enzymes that dephosphorylate something is called a phosphatase. Right? And I think we talked about enzymes. If you ever see a name of an enzyme or a word that has an ASE on the end of it, that means that it is an enzyme. A phosphatase is an enzyme that takes a phosphate off of something, and a kinase is an enzyme that adds a phosphate. So if you want to have a nice balance between an active form or an inactive form of an enzyme, what has to be in balance? If one is more active than the other, okay, then the ultimate activity of an enzyme might be too great or too small. It's always a balance between a kinase activity and a phosphatase. All right, so what kind of control is being used when you have two mechanisms working in an antagonistic way? A lot of people think that that is kind of futile process, right? The futile process would be like running three steps up the stairs and then running down three. Because how far do you get then? You end up where you started from. Okay. But in terms of control systems, why is it important to have two antagonistic mechanisms? Yeah, it maintains homeostasis. You have precise control and balance, right? So when you have a kinase operating with a phosphatase, you can get just the right level of enzymatic activity by controlling the level of phosphorylation on an enzyme. Yeah?
So phosphorylation is when a phosphate group is given into the enzyme.
Is added to? It's bound?
And
B4 is when it's taken off. And a phosphatase takes it off. A kinase puts it on. I don't know if I've mentioned that before or not, but I probably will a number of times, and we'll see a number of examples of why that's important, okay? Just using those particular enzymes. Okay. All right, other enzymes are activated when small molecules bind to them, right? And we would just call these ligands, and sometimes these are second messengers. Could anybody give me the name maybe of a second messenger? Yeah, like cyclic AMP, CAMP. Okay. All right, so here is a graph that kind of should ring a bell to you. Maybe you've seen something that looks like this. This is the rate of a chemical reaction versus substrate concentration. And we can see that as the substrate concentration increases, the rate of the chemical reaction increases as well. But at a certain substrate concentration, we can't increase the rate of the chemical reaction anymore, and that's because all of the enzyme now, right, is bound up with substrate, and we can't produce any more enzyme substrate complex because all the enzyme is used up, and that condition is what we call saturation. Where you've seen this before is with receptors. This is how we categorize receptors. Remember, receptors had saturation. They had another characteristic called specificity, and they had another characteristic called competition, right? So you can see all of those characteristics apply to enzymes as well. We don't see it on this slide, so you can see that there is a nice sort of analogy between receptors and enzymes. And as a matter of fact, in my way of thinking, it's really, for me, hard to visualize what the difference is. Right, a receptor is kind of acting like an enzyme, but it's more for information theory. But an enzyme is just speeding up the rate of a chemical reaction.
I thought enzymes were reusable.
Yes, they are reusable.
What do you mean by
reusable? Oh, by saturation right here? Okay. So what I am looking at right here is the rate of this reaction. All right, so that means, what does reaction rate mean? It could mean one of two things. Let me flip back a couple slides. Now, the rate of a chemical reaction is, all right. The rate of a reaction could mean the appearance of products, all right, the production of products, say in in concentration per time, that would be a rate, or number of molecules per time, how many molecules per minute or per second. So the reaction rate would be the appearance of products, or it could be what the disappearance of substrate. And I think you did an enzyme, you did you do the mouse respiration experiment already? Okay, and you were actually measuring the rate of that chemical reaction. But what were you measuring? You were measuring, you fill the chamber with air, and the air would get used up and the bubble, right, would move down because the pressure inside the chamber went away. So you actually measured the amount of oxygen that was being consumed. And what is that? That's a substrate for that chemical reaction. Right? So you were actually measuring the rate of respiration in that mouse. And you're measuring the disappearance of a substrate, namely oxygen. The other thing you could have measured was the appearance of carbon dioxide, but that's harder to do. All right, so either one, the disappearance of substrate or the appearance of product, is a way to measure the rate of that chemical reaction. And it is true that when you have an enzymatic reaction like this, the enzyme over here, after the reaction, is exactly the same as before. Right, so when I flip back to that last curve, think of what? The appearance of product or the disappearance of the substrate. And maybe the easiest way to look at it is what? The appearance of the product would be a measure of the reaction rate. So right here, instead of reaction rate, you could say what? The appearance of the product after the catalyzed reaction. We can see as the substrate concentration increases, right, products appear more rapidly, but then after a certain concentration, all the active sites on the enzyme that you have in that solution are bound and can't catalyze the reaction any faster than that. The only way to increase the reaction rate after you've saturated the enzyme is to, well, how could you increase the rate of the reaction? Okay, you could increase maybe the temperature. Okay, yeah, by increasing it, well, that would increase the rate of the reaction. Okay, changing the pH. Okay, but another way of doing that would be to increase the amount of enzyme that you have in solution. Just put more enzyme in there, which means what? When we put more enzyme in there, there are more active sites immediately available to bind substrate, which means that it will catalyze the reaction more quickly. All right. So what we see right here is at a constant enzyme concentration without changing enzyme concentration. Right? All right, so enzymes show saturation, they will show competition, and they show specificity. And that's just because of the substrates have to match the shape of the active site. Right? So if there is some other substrate, not the usual one that binds there, if there's another molecule that has a similar shape to the usual substrate, then it will have a tendency to bind to the active site, and that will prevent the usual substrate from binding, and that's what we call competition, right? And that might inhibit the reaction. Okay. All right, some enzymatic reactions are reversible. Here's a really nice one. Carbon dioxide and water can be combined to produce carbonic acid, and the free energy of the reactants is pretty much equal to the free energy of this product right here. So this reaction can go forwards and backwards. And in most circumstances, it's relatively slow. This happens in our body. So if we want it to happen in our body, what would we like to have in our body to make the reaction faster? An enzyme. And as a matter of fact, you can see the name of the enzyme, so you should memorize that because we're going to talk about that enzyme a lot later on in the class. It's called carbonic anhydrase. Interconverts carbonic acid with CO2 and water. All right, so this might sound a little strange to you that you have this stuff running around inside your body, but you do. Is it strange to think you have water in your body? No, not at all. What about CO2? No, because you're producing CO2 all the time in order to make ATP. All right, but this is a guy that you're not really familiar with, carbonic acid. All right, we produce a lot of carbonic acid all the time. All right, and since energy is not added to one side of this equation or the other, this really is not an endergonic nor an exergonic reaction. All right, there's probably a little energy change, but I won't even mention what side of the equation it's on. So it can go from left to right, or it can go from right to left. It really doesn't matter. There's not much of a free energy change. All right, but it is balanced like a teeter-totter. All right, so when you have a teeter-totter, and my sister, when I was growing up, was really bad, all right, because she was older than me, all right, and she would sit over here, all right, and I was up over here, okay? And if we're the same weight, what would happen? We would balance out really nice, okay? But we can get this teeter-totter to shift really fast by doing what? Well, she would hop off, and then what would happen to me? Okay, I'd come crashing down, boom, like that. All right, so this teeter-totter, depending on the weight of the teeter-totter, it could shift up or down. All right, same thing for this chemical reaction right here. All right, if we take away carbonic acid from this reaction, guess what happens? A lot of water and carbon dioxide combine to reform that carbonic acid. That's what we call the law of mass action. All right? Or if we put in a lot of carbonic acid into this solution, guess what happens? The teeter-totter shifts again to find balance. This carbonic acid then gets converted into water and carbon dioxide. So if we add a component of this reaction, it's forced in the opposite direction. right? If we remove a reactant, it's forced in the direction to reform that molecule that you take out of it. That's the law of mass action. The direction of the reaction is from the side of the equation where the concentration is higher to the side where the concentration is lower. All right, it goes by another name. It's called, anybody know what another name for that law of mass action is? No? It's called the Le Chatelier's principle. Okay? Le Chatelier. I don't know how to pronounce it. I mean, I probably don't know how to pronounce it, but I certainly don't know how to spell it. I could maybe come close. But I think I have it on the study guide for you in this chapter, Le Chatelier's principle, and there's a nice web link where you can click and go take a look at Le Chatelier's principle. All right, so for instance, if a cell produces carbon dioxide, if you have some region in your body producing a lot of carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide concentration increases, how is this reaction going to rebalance itself? What's going to happen? If your body produces a lot of carbon dioxide, does this reaction then shift carbonic acid to water and carbon dioxide?
No.
It shifts to the right. Right, so when your body produces CO2, because of carbonic anhydrase, right, then those cells are going to release a lot of carbonic acid. And the nice thing about that is that carbonic acid we will see, is very soluble in water, and that's the way that carbon dioxide is transported in your body, in your circulatory system. Not as carbon dioxide, but as carbonic acid. Because you can put almost as much carbonic acid or bicarbonate in blood as you can imagine, it gets transported very easily. Also, when you get to the lungs, right, you've transported all of that carbonic acid to the lungs, but in the lungs, what happens? What do you lose in the lungs when you exhale? What are you exhaling out of your body? Carbon dioxide. All right, so if this carbon dioxide goes away, which way does this chemical reaction shift? It shifts back to the left, so that carbonic acid comes out of solution, turns into carbon dioxide, and then you do what? You just breathe it out of your body. So it's a pretty fancy little reaction for transporting CO2. The other thing that you should see with this is that carbonic acid is an acid, right? Our metabolism produces a lot of acid in this form, and guess what we excrete? How do we excrete acid from our body?
Urine.
But I didn't talk about urine here. This is kind of amazing. We excrete a lot of acid just by breathing, by exhaling. All right, so it's kind of amazing. We're all very alien in that response. Our breath is not as acid as alien blood from the movie, but it's pretty close. Okay. All right, metabolic pathways. So Le Chatelier's principle. Right? Remember Le Chatelier's principle with that. Metabolic reactions are a sequence of enzymatic reactions that begin with one substrate and it progresses through a number of chemical reactions, right, until it produces a final product. So it's a multi-step reaction and each of the reactions are controlled by an enzyme. So here's a typical enzymatic reaction where some initial substrate gets converted into some final product, we'll just call that F, but it can't just jump there from A to F, it's got to go through all of these intermediate steps or these intermediaries. And so this is what we call a metabolic pathway, and each has an enzyme associated with it. Okay. Well, so let's just say we have substrate A being converted to F right here. And when you have a buildup of F in the body, maybe it's not being utilized anymore, do you think that this enzymatic path, well, I tell you what, let's look at this one down here on the bottom. All right. When you have a lot of F prime building up in your body, right, should this metabolic pathway still be operational if you have enough F prime? Should your body be producing more F prime if you already have enough that you need? Right. Okay. So F prime, as it builds up inside the cell, of course, is going to diffuse around inside the cell, and it can actually go back and bind to an enzyme in this metabolic pathway, and when it binds, it will change the activity of that enzyme, turning it off, so that shuts off this particular pathway right here. We call this end product inhibition. So the buildup of the final product feeds back in a, what, negative fashion, and that maintains homeostasis of what, this metabolic pathway right here. And as your body uses up F prime, what happens to this lower enzymatic pathway or metabolic pathway? It turns back on because that end product inhibition is released, right? F prime is released from enzyme number 3 over here, and that pathway opens back up, and then you build the level of F prime back up, and then what happens? Then it's shut down again, and that's how the level of F prime is maintained. In a lot of cases, okay, where end product inhibition feeds back is at a branch point. So here we see C can have a couple of different fates. It can go to form either D prime with one kind of enzyme, or it can form product D with a different kind of enzyme. So end product inhibition we usually find at a branch point, so that C doesn't build up inside the cell either. It's just put to different uses. Okay, so sometimes we call that allosteric inhibition. Okay. I deleted this one from your slide, and I think I deleted this one from your slide too, talking about metabolic diseases. But these are really interesting slides, but we can't cover all that this semester. Okay. So we're going to go right to bioenergetics. Right? Did anybody have a copy of those slides in your notes right here? I don't think so. Okay. Okay, so bioenergetics. You covered this topic in lab already, all right, but I'll just kind of review some of the laws of thermodynamics. All right, bioenergetic refers to the flow of energy in living systems, and there's a couple laws of thermodynamics. The first law just says that energy can't be created or destroyed. It can only be transformed from one kind of energy to another. All right, so who can tell me what energy is? We talk about energy here, but I don't know, what is energy?
Matter?
Einstein. I need a glass of water. Yes, Einstein did say energy is equal to matter by a little constant called C squared. All right, but that's sort of beyond this class. All right, but what's a better? Okay, I'll give you a hint. What's a better working definition of energy? Okay, energy actually gives you the ability to do work, or gives the ability of any system to do work. Okay, energy gives somebody the ability to do work, and without energy, you can't do work. When you have a lot of energy, what can you do?
Lots of
work, right? So just kind of think of it in those terms. Okay. So that's what energy is. It's the ability to do work. So in our universe, we can't create energy or destroy energy, but we can transfer it around. So could anybody give me a form of energy? And how can it be transformed from one form to another? Okay, somebody said heat. Heat? I like heat as energy. Okay. What can you transform heat energy into? Mechanical energy, for instance. That's how we drive our cars around. All right. As a matter of fact, we start out with chemical energy, energy in the form of chemical bonds and gasoline, and then we turn those chemical bonds into heat energy, and that drives the pistons up and down, which then creates mechanical energy to drive our cars around. Okay, what's another kind of way of converting energy? ATP is energy. There's chemical bonds in ATP. Yeah? How can we convert that into something? How about our muscles? What does a muscle do? It takes chemical energy in the form of ATP and converts it into the mechanical energy. Okay? So again, we can transform one kind of energy into another. Light is energy, as a matter of fact. And the different levels of energy you can visualize as different colors. Different colors are different levels of energy. And you can convert light energy into chemical energy that your brain understands. What kind of structure can convert light energy into action potentials that your brain understands?
Yeah.
That would be your retina. Yeah, your eye does that. Okay, so there are different things that can convert energy, all right, but can never create energy. We can't create energy. We can just convert it from one form to another. What would be my favorite reaction of converting energy that utilizes light and converts it into chemical energy? What is that called? That's got to be my favorite. Yeah, that's photosynthesis. That's got to be my favorite transformation energy, right? I always thought it'd be really cool to be green and have chloroplast, so you could go sit on the beach all day long and it would be like drinking a milkshake, because you could be converting that light energy into glucose all day long. But maybe in my next lifetime. Okay, so that's the first law of thermodynamics. The second law states that energy transformations increase entropy, which means that the degree of disorganization of the system somehow has to increase. So our bodies are highly organized, but in order to maintain that highly organized form, we have to excrete energy from our bodies in a very disorganized form. And that form is in the form of heat, right? So we excrete even a lot more energy as waste compared to the energy that we need to maintain our homeostasis. That's just how things work in our universe. Okay?
Is that the second law saying that energy goes from higher to lower? Is that what that's
kind of saying? Yeah, state of organization. Right. So you could kind of think of as free energy being that way. All right, but more strictly in a chemical sense, that's what we would... I won't even say what it is. Okay? Okay. So only free energy, that's energy in the organized state, can be used to do work. Right? But what's work again? I mean, what is energy? It is, the ability to do work. And the more organized that energy is, right, the higher the level it has, the more energy, the more work that it can do. All right? So systems like our bodies go from states of high free energy to states of lower free energy. All right. Well, as a matter of fact, if a chemical reaction is giving off energy, right? So you've got products you got reactants going to products. If it's giving off energy, what side of the chemical reaction does it belong on? Okay. So if you got reactants going to products, and it's giving off energy, where do we put energy? Yeah, up over here. All right. So that means that the reactants have more free energy than the products. How do we talk about that reaction?
Exergonic.
That's exergonic, right? This is an exergonic. And if we go the reverse way, that would be an endergonic reaction. Those typically are not as spontaneous, but they can happen, right? We can have an endergonic reaction. We can have an endergonic reaction in our body as long as we have what to put into this reaction right here? As long as we have energy to put into it from some source, okay? Okay, so endergonic reactions happen, but they require energy. Okay, so here is a really important endergonic reaction. Here is an organism that can take CO2 and water, right, and produce a milkshake out of it, namely glucose. All right, that's a highly endergonic reaction. So what does this organism need in order to make this endergonic reaction happen? It needs energy in the form of sunlight. Right? Anybody know what wavelengths of sunlight this plant needs? It needs everything but green. It needs blue. Okay, it needs violet. What's on the other side? Red. Okay, because what you see is the wavelengths of sunlight that the plant can't absorb and is reflected back to your eye, which is green. If the plant was using that green energy, then you couldn't see it because the plant would be gobbling it up. It's gobbling up what? Red, blue, indigo, violet. All right, to make glucose right here. All right, so the second law dictates that all living organisms require a continual input of energy. Plants obtain that energy from sunlight. All right, so they use it to make a high free energy glucose molecule. So this energy that the plant absorbs gets put into the chemical bonds, Right, so energy from sunlight is converted into chemical bonds right here. It fixes this carbon dioxide. All right, and then of course, we come along and we do what? We eat the plant. Okay, so we eat the plant and we get the glucose that the plant is making. I didn't quite hear what you said, but I missed it. I'll pay attention next time. All right. Okay, so endergonic reactions. Let's look here at a plot of free energy. All right, so this is a highly organized state right here with a lot of free energy. This is a more random state. There's less organization right here. All right, so things can happen spontaneously. So glucose, you can burn glucose. Has anybody ever burned glucose? No? Nobody's ever made creme brulee with a little butane torch or something, right? You can caramelize sugar. Right, you can burn sugar, and you can, when you burn sugar, you release all of that chemical energy. You convert glucose into carbon dioxide and water very quickly, and you use what, that flame to overcome that activation energy barrier. Right, so glucose wants to turn into carbon dioxide and water, but in that case, you need to input that activation energy. All right, so going from a high free energy to low free energy, what kind of process is that? Going from high free energy to low free energy, what kind of process is that? That's an exergonic reaction. All right. And going from low free energy to high, that is an endergonic reaction. Okay. So there's just going to be this transfer of energy. All right. So this is an exergonic reaction. We can burn glucose all at one time, but what our bodies do is break it down into a number of intermediate steps. And when you break the combustion of glucose down into a number of intermediate steps, you have a better chance of harnessing this energy for some kind of organized purpose, like maintaining homeostasis in your body. All right, so if we're going to burn glucose, what temperature does that happen at? Well, really high temperature. I don't know, hundreds of degrees. Could we function at hundreds of degrees? No way. All right, so how does our body combust glucose into carbon dioxide and water at 98 degrees? What would you do?
Enzymes.
Yeah, enzymes, right? You need to lower the activation energy, and a perfect example of that is you use a catalyst, and our body builds catalysts in terms of enzymes through this multi-step enzymatic pathway or metabolic pathway, and at each one of these steps, we can recover some of this energy that's being released to put to our own purposes, namely the synthesis of ATP. All right, so going from glucose to carbon dioxide, again, is what kind of reaction, endergonic or exergonic? An exergonic reaction. So our bodies couple this exergonic reaction to the production of ATP. All right, so what is the production of ATP? ATP is inorganic phosphate plus ADP going to ATP. Where does energy go in this reaction? Ah, good question. You're reading my mind. But let's stick with my first question first. Which way, which side should energy be on? Should energy be on the right or should it be on the left? Okay, so think of a catabolic reaction versus anabolic reaction. That's part of the definition. So in order to take two small molecules and make a big molecule out of it, you need energy. You need energy to do that. So if energy is on this side of the equation going like that, what is this reaction right here? Exergonic or endergonic? Endergonic. All right, endergonic reaction going in this direction. And then if you hydrolyze ATP, that would be exergonic, right? That's going to, because there's chemical energy in ATP. Exergonic right here. All right, so let's look at this compared to what we see up on the top. So producing ATP is endergonic, and the way that our bodies do that is by coupling this huge change in free energy from glucose to CO2. This is what, a huge exergonic reaction. It couples it to the endergonic reaction of the synthesis of ATP. All right, so this is where this last statement comes from. Right? Exergonic reactions release energy as they proceed, like going from glucose to CO2. Right? The products contain less free energy than the reactants. Exactly right. Well, that's not what I wanted to show you. Ah, this is the one I wanted to show you. Okay. All right, so cells require constant inputs of free energy. They do this by coupling endergonic reactions to exergonic reactions. So what kind of reaction are you going to get energy from? It's going to be an exergonic reaction. But what energy molecule does your body need to stay alive? It needs ATP. That's the energy molecule. How does your body make ATP? Through an endergonic reaction. Okay? So in order for this endergonic reaction to take place, namely making ATP, what does it have to be coupled with? A big exergonic metabolic pathway in order to make ATP. All right, so here we see, again, a kind of a plot of free energy. So energy is going to go from high to low. Exergonic reactions. Here is a huge metabolic pathway, this big wheel right here. So the reactants have more energy than the products. So if you have a set of reactions where the reactants have a lot more energy than the products, can you see what that is? Is that endergonic or exergonic? That's exergonic, right? Because these products have less energy. It is coupled through some mechanisms that we're going to look at, but on this slide we see it's just gears that are meshing together can drive this reaction where the reactants have lower energy than the products. So what is analogous to what I have on the board for this second reaction right here? Reactants going to products, where the products have more energy. ATP synthesis, because it's what? It's an endergonic reaction. And what is that wheel on the right over there? That's also an endergonic reaction. Okay, now that won't happen by itself unless it's coupled with what?
Exergonic
reaction. Okay. And so that's really the whole focus of the next chapter, is to look at those exergonic reactions. All right, so an exergonic reaction breaks down ATP, which is the universal energy carrier. So you might have a reaction that is highly endergonic, like muscle contraction is endergonic. It's got to get energy from someplace else to happen. Where does it get energy from? It gets energy from, quick, I'm getting tired. It gets energy from ATP, right? It gets energy from ATP. Because when ATP is broken down, that's an exergonic reaction, right? Muscle contraction is endergonic. All right, but where do you get that ATP from? Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP. Right? The reaction of making ATP is endergonic, but the only way to get it to happen is to do what? To couple it with other sets of reactions that are highly exergonic that can transfer this energy from metabolism to this reaction to make ATP. So this statement right here is really confusing, right? Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP, right? That is metabolism that we're going to look at. That's not to say that the production of ATP is an exergonic reaction. What that last sentence says is that in order for the production of ATP, which is an endergonic reaction, you have to couple it with big exergonic reactions to make it happen. And we're going to look at those big exergonic reactions in the next chapter. Okay, so here's that ATP. Where is that chemical energy stored? It's in these bonds, right? So here's a phosphate, here's a second phosphate, here's the third phosphate, so hence we call this, here is adenosine, right? Because that's an adenine base right there. What kind of sugar is this? That's a ribose. It's not a deoxyribose, it's just a regular old ribose. All right, triphosphate, and this chemical bond right here is all of these are covalent bonds, but this is even an especially high energy level covalent bond. So that when it is broken, when it's hydrolyzed, what happens to that energy? It's released. It can be reused by the cell. All right, but in order to make ATP, you got to get that energy from someplace to what? Make this bond. Okay. Anybody have a question on this slide? That just sort of gives you a little feel for what ATP looks like.
It's a high-level covalent bond?
It's a high energy. Yeah, so this little squiggle, or tilde right here, that's a high energy covalent bond, more so than most chemical bonds or covalent bonds that you find. Right, because here we see what? Another one right here. Here's a bond, but that's not the same high energy. All right, so if we have three phosphates, that's ATP. If we have two phosphates here and here, that is ADP. Notice that there still is one high energy bond left in ADP. But if it's AMP, are there any high energy phosphate bonds left? No, because this is just a straight line right here. Okay, so it's only in this last one. So this is the alpha phosphate, the beta phosphate, and this would be the gamma phosphate. It's just the last one. All right, so kind of memorize this shape in your mind for what ATP looks like. All right, that's an energy carrier. All right, so we looked at a number of different kinds of chemical reactions in your body, like for making polymers or breaking polymers down. What kind of chemical reaction does your body use to build a polymer? Like to take two monosaccharides and put them together. Or to take two amino acids and put them together. Yeah, dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay. Or to put a fatty acid onto a glycerol molecule, dehydration synthesis reaction. And to break glycogen down, which is made up of glucose, yeah, hydrolysis reaction. Okay. So those are very common. Here's another set of chemical reactions that are just as important and just as common. They're called oxidation reduction reactions. And before you become familiar with these reactions, you just have to memorize the definition of what an oxidation reduction reaction is, or what an oxidation is and what a reduction is. Okay. When a molecule gains electrons, we say it is reduced. So certain molecules can gain electrons, and it will be an electron carrier, right? It's going to carry those electrons around. But in order for a molecule to gain an electron, what does another molecule have to do? It has to be able to surrender electrons, right? So when a molecule surrenders or loses electrons, we say it is oxidized. So when a molecule is reduced, that also means that another molecule is oxidized. So you cannot have a reduction reaction without an oxidation reaction happening at the same time, right? It's really the same reaction, only one molecule is oxidized and another is reduced. And so that's why we call certain kinds of reactions oxidation reduction reactions, because electrons hop from one molecule to another. All right, a reducing agent is that agent that can donate an electron to something. All right, so what happens to a reducing agent in an oxidation reduction reaction? If the reducing agent, yes, that's really hard to see, okay? A reducing agent becomes oxidized because it does what? It donates electrons, it loses electrons, all right? All right, so if during the test, if this becomes terribly confusing, where you have to start is with these two definitions right here. If something receives or gains electrons, it becomes reduced, all right? And you can just go step by step to figure out what's going on right there. All right, an oxidizing agent accepts electrons. And there is one molecule that accepts a lot of electrons in our body, and it is called oxygen. And this is where that term came from, oxidizing agent, because oxygen just loves to accept electrons. All right, and when oxygen accepts electrons, what happens to it? It becomes reduced. All right, now that's a real mind tweezer right there. But you guys some of you seem to be picking up pretty fast. All right, but just always start with these two definitions right here. All right, so oxidation and reduction. Reductions are always coupled reactions. Forget this statement right here. That might help some people, but I really don't focus very much on this statement. Because what I like to focus on is what? Electrons, not necessarily hydrogen atoms moving one way or the other. But you'll see that sort of happening. Okay, coenzymes that play important roles as electron carriers, All right, you're going to see hydrogens participate in this, but as electron carriers are NAD and FAD. And here, please change your notes, because NAD is really an ion. It has a positive charge. All right, so anytime I say NAD, I really should be saying what? NAD plus, right? And some people just say NAD or NAD plus, but I just say NAD. Doesn't matter what you say, okay? So NAD and FAD are coenzymes, because what's a coenzyme again? What does a coenzyme do for us? It's a large organic molecule, and it's carrying something from one set of chemical reactions to another, or from one organelle to another or something. And in this particular case, what are NAD and FAD carrying from one set of chemical reactions to another? It's going to be carrying these electrons. Going to be carrying electrons, because they become reduced. Okay, they become reduced, and they carry, yeah, so put electrons right here. It's easier for me to see, and it probably means that it will be easier for most of you to see too. If you'd like to look at hydrogens, that's okay. All right, so these are also vitamins. That's all I'm going to say about that. Okay. This is what they look like. These are not, I don't think these are exam figures. You don't have to recognize these as being NAD or FAD, but I include them because you might see some kind of familiar structure. What does this look like right here? This looks like a nucleotide, right? We see a ribosugar and a base and some phosphates right here. All right, so this is nicotinamide dinucleotide, because what do you see? I see a nucleotide here and a nucleotide here. It's a dinucleotide. That's where that term comes from. All right, and when it's in an oxidized state, it has a plus sign right on this nitrogen. Oh, can you see that?
No.
Sort of, no? I can't focus that projector up there any better than this. But there's a plus sign right here, so NAD is really what? NAD plus, right? It's an ion. But it can be reduced. It can accept two electrons and one hydrogen atom, and where they're placed is right in this position here, okay? And the two electrons then are in orbits around this nitrogen right here, so it's carrying two high-energy electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another. So this is NAD in the reduced state. This is NAD in the oxidized state. All right, this is what FAD looks like. All right, and again, FAD can accept two electrons and two protons, so it still remains neutral before and after it is reduced. It doesn't become an ion or anything, because it accepts two negative charges and two positive charges, so it stays the same level of ionization. All right, but because it accepts two protons, we call it FADH2. So FADH2 is the reduced form of FAD, because along with those protons, what did it accept?
Two
electrons, right? And FAD is going to carry those high-energy electrons around in the cell and eventually donate them to other molecules. So just a little bit as some foreshadowing, you can see that electrons can hop from one molecule to another, right, changing the free energy of these molecules. And if you want to think about these molecules as being like a wire, you're welcome to do that, right? Because we have wires in our buildings right here that are transferring what? Electrons from high energy to low energy, and we build devices like light bulbs that can utilize that energy and those electrons as they flow through it to what? To form light or to run electric motors or whatever. Okay, but biology has used these electrons for a little bit different purposes, and that is to make chemical bonds because of that, what, first law of thermodynamics. All right, so can you see like a little ATP right here? Another nucleotide here and here? Sort of. Okay. All right, so those are, now were those cofactors or coenzymes?
Coenzymes,
because they're big organic molecules, and because only coenzymes carry things around inside the cell, right? They're not just a cofactor. Okay. All right, so our next chapter Our next chapter, what is our next chapter? I believe it's 5. Our next chapter is 5. And, look, we have a chapter 5. But that's okay if we didn't, because they're online anyway. All right, so think of some good questions regarding that last chapter. Okay, so here's a chapter where we're going to talk about cell respiration and metabolism. And I'll just ask you a question, but I don't want to answer it right now. Maybe in a day or two or next week you can give me an answer. And that is, what's the purpose of cell respiration? What's the purpose of cell respiration? Okay, we're going to look at a whole bunch of chemical reactions, and it's easy to get lost in the reactions and lose sight of what the overall purpose of cell respiration is. All right, and basically it's really simple, but we have to look at some details between now and then. All right, so we're going to look at glycolysis, we're going to look at aerobic respiration, and maybe a little bit of time looking at fat and protein metabolism. Okay. Oh, well, here are some terms that I used previously today, but I see I haven't defined them yet. All right, and the all-encompassing term right here is metabolism. Metabolism is just all the sets of chemical reactions or all of the chemical reactions that are happening inside your body. Because our living processes are basically chemical reactions. So all of those reactions added together are what we call metabolism. And furthermore, we can break metabolism down into two subcategories. The two subcategories are catabolism and anabolism. Catabolism breaks down molecules. All right, so when you break down a molecule like ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate, what do you get out of it? You get energy out of it, right? All right, so catabolic reactions are exergonic reactions, right? The other kind of reactions are what? The reverse of that. These are what we call anabolic reactions, when we take two small molecules like inorganic phosphate, ADP, and make a bigger molecule out of it. And that is an endergonic reaction, because in order for that to happen, what do you need? Yeah, you need energy of some kind. Okay, to make ATP, you need energy. And that's what we call an anabolic reaction. All right. So anabolism makes larger molecules and requires energy. Okay, the source of body's large energy storage compounds are what? They are, the large energy storage compounds are big molecules. Like ATP, all right? Well, it's bigger than the reactants. What's another big molecule that stores a lot of energy?
Glycogen.
Like glycogen, huge molecule. Even lipids, right? Fatty acids are big, long molecules. There's a lot of energy stored up in them. And they could be broken down, okay? We can break those large molecules down into smaller ones, and we get energy out of it because that's an exergonic reaction, okay? All right, so this slide I want you to refer to a lot during this chapter and maybe even some subsequent chapters. I have some modifications to this figure. This one that might even be an exam figure. I don't know. I can't remember just yet. All right, so this has four important metabolic pathways. Four important. They're not labeled on here. All right, so before we leave today, I want to make sure that I tell you what these four metabolic pathways are. Some of them are labeled nicely. All right, but here we can see blood glucose in a blood vessel, all right, and that has to be maintained. What do we call it when somebody can't regulate their blood glucose? That's called diabetes. Yeah, different kinds of diabetes, but certainly it's diabetes of some form. And glucose is very important because one organ in your body relies almost exclusively on glucose for energy, and that's the brain, okay? So that has to be maintained. It can't be too high, it can't be too low. So when you're in a fed state, right, like you've been drinking milkshakes all day, here it is inside the digestive tract, what's happening? It is absorbing that glucose and putting it into the blood, right? So when you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose has the tendency to elevate, right, or to maintain itself. Now, when you go to sleep at night, right, and You've absorbed all the glucose from your digestive tract. Blood glucose has a tendency to decrease, but you do have an organ in your body, namely the liver, and the liver is the organ that stores glycogen. And the liver gets a signal from the pancreas to break glycogen down into glucose, and the liver then secretes glucose into the blood, maintaining blood glucose levels. All right, so when you're in the fed, so this pathway right here represents the fed state, maintaining blood glucose levels. This pathway over here is in the fasted state. So the liver maintains blood glucose when you're in a fasted state. This one right here is dominated by insulin. This pathway over here is dominated by another hormone that we don't talk about clinically very much. That's called glucagon. But the effects of insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's a good thing because that provides what? Precise control and balance. All right, so glucose, and we looked at how glucose moves across the different epithelial membranes, right, via what? Facilitated diffusion and secondary active transport mechanisms using facilitated diffusion using the GLUT4 transporter. Right, we'll look a lot more in detail at that later on. All right, so then glucose can leave the circulatory system and enter a cell. Of course, if it has the what's the passport that allows glucose to enter a cell? What's the signal that allows glucose to enter a cell? Okay. What hormone you know decreases blood glucose? Insulin, for instance. That's right. Because if you take insulin when you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose is going to bottom out. Right. So insulin should only be administered when you're in a fed state. So if there is an insulin signal, glucose can go from plasma into the cell cytoplasm. Right. This is just kind of a refresher of what we talked about already. Now, once it's in the cytoplasm, it can be used for cellular respiration. The first pathway is what we call glycolysis. That's pathway number one, where glucose is broken down into pyruvic acid. That is glycolysis. And can anybody remember how many carbon atoms are in glucose? There's six, that's right. It's a six carbon sugar. And then on every carbon there is there's a H2O. Right, on every carb, so it's what, a carbohydrate, it's a carbohydrate. So you kind of picture in your mind the overall formula of what glucose looks like. But it's got six. Glycolysis means, I tell you what, you tell me, what does lysis mean? The breaking down, right, of glucose. Glycolysis means the splitting of glucose. And so glycolysis is like taking a scissors and chopping glucose into two parts, right smack in the middle. So if it does that, how many carbon atoms does pyruvic acid have?
Three.
It's got three. That's right. So then that energy in those bonds can be used. This is an exergonic reaction, right? So the energy in those bonds, as it's being released by glycolysis, can be used to do what? Run an important endergonic reaction, namely synthesis of ATP. Okay, so this is the first one. This right here, this color right here, represents the cytoplasm of the cell. And so you see the cytoplasm of the cell does make a little bit of ATP, but what part of the cell did you learn?
Mitochondria.
Yes, that produces a lot of ATP. What organelle? And that is the mitochondria. The mitochondria even makes more ATP than cytoplasm. So these products right here, pyruvic acid, can have one of two fates. If there is oxygen present in the cell, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria and it can then produce a lot of ATP. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But if there is no oxygen inside the cell, like when blood supply gets cut off to it, or if a muscle is exercising very strenuously, when a muscle contracts, it turns into a solid mass. Ooh, like, yeah, this one right here. It's so solid that blood can't even flow into it, okay, when it turns into that solid. And when blood can't flow into it, there's no oxygen available, and what happens? Glycolysis turns into this anaerobic pathway and produces lactic acid. So anaerobic respiration means it's a process that happens without oxygen. Okay. Okay, so we got glycolysis. Now what if there is oxygen? That opens up the mitochondria to aerobic respiration. So aerobic just means in the presence of oxygen. Here is the second reaction that I want you to become familiar with. It's called a preparatory reaction. That's not on this slide right here. The preparatory reaction takes pyruvic acid and converts it into a molecule that can enter the Krebs cycle. All right, and I'll describe that in really some nice detail in just a little bit. All right, the third reaction that produces ATP is what we call the Krebs cycle. All right, so where does the Krebs cycle take place? Inside the cell, inside the mitochondria, not in the cytosol. This actually should say what? Cytosol right here, because cytoplasm includes organelles as well in the strictest definition of it. Some of us that are older are having a hard time adapting to that. Right? Cytosol is what? Just a fluid part inside the cell minus organelles. That's what should be up over here because mitochondria is really part of the cytoplasm. All right, so the second reaction is the preparatory reaction. The third reaction is the Krebs cycle. And the fourth reaction is electron transport right here. These things are all important exergonic reactions. What does your body do with most exergonic reactions? It couples it to an endergonic reaction, namely the synthesis of ATP. Okay, so those are the four. Should I say that one more time?
Yes.
Glycolysis is one. Preparatory reaction is number two. Krebs cycle is number three. And electron transport is number four. Those are the highly exergonic reactions that the cell or mitochondria use to make ATP. Okay, and in so doing, what are the final products of aerobic respiration? What are the final products of aerobic respiration? They're on this slide right here. They're carbon dioxide and water. All right. What's the final product of anaerobic respiration?
Lactic
acid. But of course, don't forget, ATP is being produced in these reactions right here. All right, so we're going to refer to this one as a grand picture of some more specific metabolic pathways inside the body. The first one, what's that first one again? Glycolysis, and what's that? That's the splitting of glucose into pyruvate. All right. So it's a metabolic pathway in which glucose is converted into 2-pyruvates. And does glycolysis require oxygen? It's part of this anaerobic pathway right here. Does not require oxygen. What organelle requires oxygen?
Mitochondria,
not the cytosol. Okay, the overall net reaction is glucose is going to be broken down into 2-pyruvates, right? Because the pyruvate is a 3-carbon molecule. But it's also going to take 2 ADBs and 2 inorganic phosphates and make 2 ATPs out of it. Right? It's also going to take 2 NAD pluses and reduce the NAD pluses into 2 NADHs. Now, what can you tell me about this NADH right here? What is it? It's a coenzyme. That means that it's carrying something around. What's it carrying around? High energy electrons. It's carrying high energy electrons that can be used later to make even more ATP, okay, if the conditions are right. All right, so this is glycolysis. Notice, no oxygen. Where does it take place? If you don't see that on the slide, you might want to jot that down on this slide. It happens in the cytosol, right? So these are just enzymatic reactions. All right, so glycolysis is exergonic. You could go back to the previous chapter, right? Glycolysis is sort of like incomplete combustion of glucose on its way to be converted into CO2. So it makes 2 ATPs, 2 NADHs. All right, so, but in order to get glycolysis started, that glucose, for a couple of different reasons, has to be phosphorylated in order for glycolysis to happen. And the molecule that's used to phosphorylate things usually is ATP. So it costs some energy to get glycolysis working, namely 2 ATP. So one of the functions of when glucose is phosphorylated, you all know that glucose is a fairly highly hydrophilic molecule because of these. What kind of groups are these right here? This one here, that's a hydroxyl group. Right, and so this makes a nice polar covalent bond right here. So glucose does not have a natural tendency to move across a plasma membrane because it is hydrophilic by itself. But you know what? It is even less hydrophilic when it's bound to a phosphate molecule. Look at all these negative charges on there now. Now you have this big, bulky, hydrophilic region right here, just like the plasma membrane. It's impossible for glucose to leave the cell once it becomes phosphorylated. So phosphorylation traps glucose inside the cell so the cell doesn't run out of energy in most cells. All right, so phosphorylation traps glucose inside the cell because that phosphate group is highly hydrophilic. All right, so here we have a plot of free energy versus the process of glycolysis in a nice diagrammatic form. We don't see any names of the intermediates. We don't see any names of enzymes right here. But at least we can at least look at glycolysis from a thermodynamic standpoint. So here's the free energy of glucose. In order to get glycolysis to proceed, what do we have to do to the free energy of glucose? We have to bump it up. And we do that by spending two ATPs. We phosphorylate glucose twice, so it becomes glucose, what, diphosphate. All right? And now it cannot leave the cell. So it's now even at a higher energy level, so now it can be broken down into smaller molecules through a number of enzymatic steps. And in one of the enzymatic steps, it's an oxidation reduction reaction. So NAD plus is reduced to NADH. That happens twice. Here is another step in which two ADPs can be converted to ATP. And so what does this do? Now for the overall energy balance in terms of ATP so far with glycolysis. It's equal, right? We spent two to get it going. We got two back already. So now it's just kind of an even game. And then one of the last steps, we can see that two more ADPs can be phosphorylated when we make pyruvic acid. So this is the net gain of ATP production by glycolysis as these intermediates start to flow downhill. So is going from intermediate number one over here down to pyruvic acid, is that an endergonic reaction or an exergonic reaction? It's exergonic because you see it's losing free energy. But what does your cell do with that free energy that's being released? It's being used to make ATP, right? That's because that's an endergonic reaction. So the net result of glycolysis is two ATP and two NADHs right here. That is glycolysis. And before we go, this is what glycolysis really looks like. And sometimes I have my students memorize all of these intermediates and sometimes I don't. And I think this semester, let's see, last semester I didn't. So that means this semester... okay, so maybe this whole year I won't make everybody memorize all these intermediates, but nonetheless, this is glycolysis. Right here you start with glucose, you phosphorylate it twice, you get, and it gets isomerized into fructose, which is what, 1,6-biphosphate, and this is where it splits into two separate molecules, and then these two separate molecules proceed through these reactions down to pyruvic acid. And you can see the steps where NADH is made. And it happens, what, twice for every glucose because you've split glucose into two molecules, right? And the same for ATP production. All right, so this won't be an exam figure. But you might say, what is the free energy of glucose compared to pyruvic acid? Glucose has more free energy than pyruvic acid does. Where did some of that free energy end up? It ended up in ATP, and it also ended up in NADH. Okay? And the rest of that free energy is released as heat to make sure that this reaction happens spontaneously. So maybe even most of that excess energy is lost as heat. All right, so that's it for today. So next time, tell me where we're going to start. Lactic acid pathway, which is... right here. Okay. Okay, so you gotta keep studying and applying yourself with this stuff. Because I know it's not really easy. Go ahead.
And then the other way was you said the NADH.
Oh, glycolysis makes ATP?
Where does the energy go?
Yeah, where did the energy in glucose go?
To ATP, and then you said you called that energy because it's essential energy.
because it's high energy electrons in there. Because energy can either be created or destroyed, and if here you have more energy and here you have less, it's got to go someplace. It just can't go nowhere. So it goes into ATP and NADH. Only some things that are happening inside of it.